The first thing that I remember, wow, that's that goes back a long time. I think one of my first memories is actually, and I hadn't spoken to you about this earlier, Matt, is we actually lived in ch the Channel Islands in Guernsey
What?
for about, I think, 12 months or 18 months when I was 4 or 5 years old. I think back in the day, it was during the height of the Troubles. My dad was like a construction site manager, and I think he picked up the Sunday Times one Sunday and actually looked in the paper. And they were looking for somebody to build a leisure centre, I think, in Guernsey.
Wow.
So off we went as a family for like 18 months, and I actually remember going to school in the Channel Islands. I mean, we had this like this beautiful house from the beach. It was like 20 meters from the beach, so I
Unbelievable.
would have been about 4 or 5 years old, and I really, really remember that. We moved back to Belfast then after about 12 months or 18 months or whatever. But I have really fond memories of spending time on the beach in Guernsey and going to school in Guernsey. In fact, so much so that I end up going back there as a student to work during my summer holidays as well.
Wow. What a great life experience, like so different to the streets of Belfast that I'm sure we'll talk about in a second.
It was, and obviously I don't remember what Northern Ireland was like in 74 or 75, but I mean it probably was at the height of some of the worst scenes of the Troubles. So I think
Yeah.
it was a good opportunity for mom and dad to take me in. But I had only one sister at the time; my other sister hadn't been born, and we ended up. And Guernsey's a lovely, like idyllic little island. It's only 7 miles long and 3 miles wide, but I think that good sunshine there as well and beautiful beaches.
Incredible. So yeah, look, hello and welcome to Best of Belfast, the podcast that celebrates Northern Ireland and the incredible people in it. You've already been hearing from Chris Gunning, who is the Finance Transformation Service Lead at Heineken in Amsterdam, where he has been living with his family over the last 20 years. Chris started off back in Belfast studying an accountancy degree in Queen's. And since then, honestly, it just seems like he's lived and worked every single country in the world. Like, that's an exaggeration, but he's worked all over the world on every continent except Antarctica. I just fact checked that. Have you been to Antarctica?
No, I haven't been
There
to
you go.
Antarctica.
Okay,
I got
that's
pretty close to
accurate.
it once, but I got to the southern tip of Chile, which is about as close to
Flip
Antarctica as you get.
me.
So.
And he was working for global tech companies. He's working for an automotive business. And now, of course, for one of the biggest beer brands in the world. So, again, just a wee bit of bullet point context before we jump in. Chris is also a self-confessed metalhead. He's an avid kayaker down the canals of Amsterdam. And, I'm going to be honest, I think he's the most James Bond-like accountant that I've ever met in my life. And I'm not even sure if accountant is the right word for Chris, but you will all will be revealed as we go forward here. And Chris, I guess this is a really exciting interview for me. It's an interview like no other because I've decided just to abandon my usual format. Usually I ask questions and there's response, but going through all the stuff that you kindly provided and the research and stuff, I'm literally just going to throw prompts at you to tease out some of the stories that really piqued my curiosity and interest while we were prepping for this show. Before we jump into the first prompt, then, I do have to say that today's episode is part of our ongoing series with NI Connections, and that's where we share the stories of incredible Northern Irish people living and working overseas. You can check out all the other episodes as part of this series at niconnections.com, which is also where you can sign up for a free monthly newsletter, which features our exciting and far-reaching global community and diaspora. So, Chris, we'll start off relatively easy, and then we'll get into some of the crazier stuff as we go. Me about growing up in Belfast, in the 70s. After that, 18 month on the island as such.
Hey, Matt. Yeah, great talking to everybody today. And thank you to Northern Ireland Connections for putting us in touch. I think it's great to be part of the Northern Ireland diaspora across the world, and I'm always, happy to be associated with Belfast. So great being part of this podcast. Growing up in Northern Ireland, yeah, I mean it was fun. I mean, I think we grew up in a reasonably middle class area in the south part of the city, and we had a lot of friends on the street. I mean, I have many memories, as I'm sure many of the children of the 70s and the 80s do in Belfast, of just constantly being outside. I mean, these days I can't get my kids off computers and YouTube
That's
and
not the
Nintendo
truth.
Switches. Oh, it's unbelievable. But back in the day, we were never at home. We were out running the streets. We would be playing marbles. We'd be playing footy against the walls with all the boys and all the girls in the street. I guess back in those days we only had two or three TV channels, so it was probably a lot more fun.
Talk to me then about taking the bus to school, because you taking the bus to school would be very different to me taking the bus to school in terms of the sort of things you would have experienced.
Oh yeah. So look, you know, when I went to, I guess after I got the 11 and plus, I ended up going to the same school that my father had gone to, and that was across town. You know, we lived in South Belfast, and my school was in North Belfast. So I would get up early every morning, 7:30, and I'd get on the big red bus and go down into town, and then I'd have to change, and then go on another bus. But these were the days when Royal Avenue had big security gates at either end. Now, you know, again, people of my age will remember those. So, you know, your bus would go through the first part of the security gate, and the bus driver would have to stop, and the police and the army would get on the bus and hook around your school bags looking for, I guess, devices. And then you'd get through to the other end of the gates, and the same thing would happen. And this would happen twice a day, you know, every day, you know, going to school, coming back from school, really crossing the city centre, which I think was a bit of a fortress in the 70s and the 80s. Now, it's amazing when I go back to Belfast today, just really seeing how Royal Avenue has really changed. Even Castle Court, when I was going to school, wasn't there. I think it only appeared in the sort of early 90s. But very, very, you know, I think about, you know, my kids going to school. Now, my kids go to school just around the corner. They can walk. And next year, my daughter's going to go to high school, so she'll be able to cycle
Nice.
here in Amsterdam. But, you know, it was very strange having those big security gates across town. And I guess that's very different today, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, talk to me about buying Stiff Little Fingers record at the age of nine.
So I'm glad you've heard of Stiff Little Fingers, one of the best bands to ever come out of Belfast. So I think I was primary five or primary six at the time, and I think this was just before my love of heavy metal. But there was a friend of mine, and his big brother was big into the punk scene. You know, in fact, they just lived across the road from the Outcasts.
Epic.
I don't know if you remember the Outcasts and Greg Cowan and the guys. But he got me into Stiff Little Fingers, and I remember going down and buying the early singles, the early 7 inches, and you know, it was fantastic. Just that you know, across community teenage angst and anger that these guys were putting on record. You know, tunes like Alternative Ulster and Suspect Device, real in your face, you know, noise and punk. So for a 9 or 10 year old, this was blowing my world and really rocking my world. And you know, I still follow SLF today. I think one of the things I have actually started during the pandemic and during lockdown, because everywhere shut, I can't go to concerts, I can't go to gigs, there's no record shops open, I started pretty much scouring and looking on online marketplaces, and eBay, or the local Dutch equivalent of eBay, for, you know, old albums. You know, I'm a cheapskate. I won't pay more than 4 or 5 euros for them. But I've managed to hunt down the entire Stiff Little Fingers back collection now on vinyl,
Very
very
cool.
cheaply from weird parts of the world. But you know, I love them. I still love them so much that I think it was 2 or 3 years ago I went back to see them. I think they play in Custom House Square every summer. Now it didn't feel like summer. I think it chucked it down with rain, from like 7 at night to midnight. But just being with all the old Belfast punks in Custom House Square in that beautiful setting for an outdoor stage, watching these guys who are much older than myself on stage, but just really rocking it. Like, I mean, a fantastic band. I've also
So
seen them
good.
in the
So
Netherlands.
then take us cross town, then take us over to East Belfast and to the after hours on a Sunday night at the Super Bowl outlet.
Oh wow! Can you remember that? So I guess, yeah, when we were students, you know, we all had our part-time jobs. So I think I was probably first or second year college. I went to Queen's. You know, this is where I was doing my accountancy degree. And a friend of mine started working for this place called the Cincinnati Cooler Company. So it's a very trendy thing. Now, I think it was on Botanic Avenue. So I guess now you walk down Botanic Avenue and every second shop is it's a deli or a fancy restaurant or a, you know, a breakfast place. Back in these days, that didn't exist, you know. I mean, so I think Cincinnati Cooler Company, it was something like out of the Back to the Future. It was like a very clean American diner style. But our unique selling point was frozen yogurt. Now, frozen yogurt, I don't see a lot of it these days, but I guess it was like ice cream. But we would do toasties and frozen yogurt. It was all very glamorous. I don't know why on earth they employed me. I think I used to torture the customers. I'd crank up the Slayer or the Red Hot Chili Peppers music, and I'd probably scare a few customers off. But you know, and maybe it was to get rid of me from the posh outlet. or I think I just volunteered, but they actually had another outlet, and it wasn't in East Belfast. The Super Bowl at the time was right in the heart of the city centre. It was real. I think it was Bedford Street, round about where Dean's restaurant is, all those nice restaurants. And it was like a 10-lane Super Bowl, and it had this thing called Laser Quest, which I guess was, you know, you're shooting people in the dark with lasers. So they sort of, I don't know whether they promoted me or demoted me, but they moved me to that location. And I loved working particularly on a Sunday night, because what they did is they closed it to the public, but let in, I guess, members of the, I think it was mostly the Chinese community, when the restaurants would close on a Sunday night at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock, these guys would come in and you know, they would have the run of the place. We would serve them drinks, we would serve them food. But the beauty was I would get lots and lots of games of bowling. Now, I hate bowling now. I think it put me off it for life. But it was, you know, it was a great adventure, and you know, a fantastic place to work. You know, Cincinnati Cooler Company. So you know, enjoyed the Sunday night stints there, and enjoyed working in Botanic Avenue as well. It probably wasn't my only odd, or not necessarily odd, but unusual job in Belfast. One of the beauties of being a student back in the 90s was, you know, this was the day before email. People actually used to write letters. People used to write Christmas cards. Now, I have to say, I'm a terrible man for writing Christmas cards. I don't do it these days. I'm very, very lazy. But back in the day, you know, everybody would write a Christmas card. So every Christmas for about 2 weeks, the post office would put an ad in the university for extra staff. So me and my buddies used to go and sign up. And I think I did it a couple of years in a row. You know, you go down early in the morning to Tomb Street, your big suitcase, get on the bus, you know, lug it around the streets. But I was very lucky. I think 1 year I got my granny's route. So I was able to, my granny and my granda. So I was able to call in for a wee cup of tea. And I think another year I managed to even get my own house, my mum and dad's house. So again, probably skive off for half an hour, 45 minutes, you know, bring after posting a few letters, come in, put the feet up and have a wee cup of tea, and then off on my merry way again. I think we did it twice a day. I think we had to go back at lunchtime, get a refill of the post sack.
That's mad.
And do it again. Yeah, it was fun.
Crazy. This is one that I'm just left scratching my head, and I don't even really know how to set it up. So again, I'll just throw it at you. Native American reservation.
Wow. Yeah, the Navajo tribe, for anybody into their Native American tribes. So this is actually got a nice Northern Ireland connection to it, Matt, in a sad way as well. It was part of what they call the spirit of Enniskillen bursaries. So I think there'd been a big boom, unfortunately, I think, in Enniskillen round about it was somewhere in the late 80s. But off the back of that, Gordon Wilson, I think he later became a senator, Senator Gordon Wilson or Sir Gordon Wilson. He lost his daughter in that, but in the back of that, he and the government set up a foundation, a bursary project, to get people from all walks of life from Northern Ireland, you know, Catholic and Protestant from the age of, I think, from about 16 up to 19, girls and boys, you know, from, you know, all sorts of ways of life. And they put us together and they sent us to different parts of the world to try and understand and study cultures and conflict and how others would get on and, you know, resolve their conflict or deal with their conflict. I think one group went to Mexico. I think one group went to Quebec, but we were lucky enough. I managed to get in a group. I think it was seven other girls. Don't ask me why I was the only boy. If any of the girls are listening, I'd certainly say hello to them. But it was a, you know, a life-changing experience. You know, we'd get on the plane. I think we even stopped off in Washington, D.C. for a couple of days. It was my first time, unbelievable, in the States. But then we flew out to Arizona. So this little tiny town, it's called Tuba City, in the middle of a Navajo reservation. I think it's a couple hundred miles. The nearest city was Flagstaff. And it really was a Navajo boarding school. You know, the Navajo Native Americans were the kids would come to learn about culture and tradition and history, but also do their maths, or math, I guess, as Americans would say, and their English. So we lived in this amazing, like, we pretty much lived in the boarding school. So I actually shared the room. My roommate was the Navajo chief's son.
Are you serious?
Which, yeah. So
how old were you?
So I would have been 19. I would have been 19, and it was just amazing. So you're dropped in, first time really, you know, out of Northern Ireland by yourself in America, living on this reservation. And, you know, we would do amazing things with the kids. You know, we would join them in class and we would have lunch with them. And I guess it's like a typical American high school that you'd probably see on TV these days. But, you know, at the weekends and the evenings, they would do amazing things with us. We would camp out under stars beside the lakes. We would ride horses across the canyons. I remember, I think it was the first time ever I was on a horse. Some of the girls I was with were experienced horse riders. And just for hours, you know, sort of Monument Valley type of things through the desert, through the canyons, we would be riding the horses. But I think the most poignant moment was we were hiking into the Grand Canyon. So everybody's seeing the Grand Canyon on TV, and it's, you know, it's even more beautiful when you see it in real life. But we went, as the group of us, we hiked about 2 or 3 hours down into the canyon, and it was sweltering hot. This is the Arizona desert. It's about 40 degrees centigrade. But I remember on the way up the hill, about an hour from the top, you know, this Navajo chief's son who I was rooming with, he said, "Now let's make a sacrifice to Mother Earth." So, you know, this is the days before Greta and the whole you know, climate change and environmental stuff. Sure. You know, he said, let's make a sacrifice to Mother Earth. So we all emptied our water bottles out onto the burning hot sand, and then carried, you know, climbed the last mile, the last hour up the hill without any water. But, you know, that was his way of giving back to the planet, you know, Father Sky and Mother Earth.
Fascinating.
Which was amazing. And, you know, we learned other stuff about how they dealt. They, you know, they had conflict the same way we had conflict in Northern Ireland. They had conflict with another tribe. There was the Hopi tribe, sometimes spill into violence, obviously not on the same scale as we were used to in Northern Ireland. But also, you know, we'd understand their tensions with, you know, the Anglo-Saxon American who had forced them on the reservations. And it was just, you know, it was a humbling experience to be able to come back. And I remember when we came back from Arizona, we did a lot of press with the TV, with the newspapers. I think we were even up in Stormont with some of the, I guess that they weren't MPs at the time. I'm not sure what they were, councillors or whatever. But yeah, very, very humbling experience. And I think that's what really gave me some of my thirst for adventure and for travel, Matt, truly.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, what an unbelievable experience. Maybe perhaps another humbling experience. I did have a chuckle whenever I read this.
Oh no.
Crying getting your hair cut by your girlfriend.
Oh my God.
And that skips us forward a wee bit, but I think it's a good place to jump to next.
And I think that's it's bringing back tears to my eyes now. So it does go back to, we were speaking a little bit about heavy metal there. You know, I think even when I was at high school, I stopped cutting my hair. You get all the names, hippie and headbanger and all of that. But through my whole 4 years of college, you know, when I was doing an accountancy degree, and, you know, after all of my best friends are in accounting. But I think I certainly, out of everybody, probably I was more on the counterculture side of things than most, and kept the long hair. You know, I'd rock up to Queens with that. It was more of probably a grungy look, you know, a Chris Cornell or an Eddie Vedder look, I guess, at the time. And that was me. That was my look. You know, I just had this long, heavy metal hair. But I remember we were going for the interviews with all of the big accountancy firms, you know, all the big ones, KPMG, Ernst & Young, Deloitte, PwC, whoever there was. And of course, you know, going for the interviews, they don't think they were expecting this guy to rock up. I think I was good. I put it in ponytail for them. But I think most of them balked in horror, going, no, this guy doesn't look like an accountant. We're not going to hire him. But I have to say, I have to give credit. There was one guy. Turns out later, he actually turned out to be a punk. I think he used to have pink hair in the 70s.
Love that.
He says, "Yeah, that's fine. It's only hair. Promise me, you know, you're not going to join for a year and a half. But if I make you a job offer now, promise me you'll cut it the day before you join."
Wow.
And I went, yeah, I promised. I sort of forgot about it for a year and a half, and I went off and I did my thing and went to lots of gigs and stuff. Then I remember the night before my first ever professional job in finance and accountancy, joining the accountancy firm, I had to get my girlfriend at the time. You know, I think, again, it was too cheap to go to a barber. She literally just cut off the ponytail. I'm not sure whether she still has it. She probably threw it out.
Kitchen scissors.
Heartbreaking. Yeah, just took scissors and 5 or 6 years worth of hard work and growth was gone. But look, I mean, it was... you know, the 4 years that I studied accounting in Belfast, I think was one of the best foundations for what was to follow with my professional career. So I guess I don't regret it. I have managed to grow a nice lockdown beard over the last 14 months just to make up for things. A little bit more grey than my hair was back in the 90s. But that's been my pet project over the last 14 months.
That's just the wisdom coming out, man. That's all that is.
It is. I like stroking it. You know, I feel like ZZ Top. And, you know,
so, so good. And I mean, you know, you talk about, you know, studying accountancy and how that's really given you the foundation for everything. I love your story because it shows people that you can do so much with an accountancy degree. Like, I think people have it in their head. It's like, yeah, I just go and I work in an office in Belfast and that's it. But I love how you've kind of taken that and you've really run with it. And you've actually used it to serve some of the values and the things that you really wanted. And one of them being traveling, you know?
Yeah, no. And I think, you know, having spent time, you know, with, you know, living in Guernsey, working with the Navajo Indians, in fact, even traveling across America, we did a big road trip with friends just before we started the accountancy life. I got a real thirst for just a travel and adventure and working in different cultures and environments. And I think one of the things that, you know, this was still before the peace agreement, you know, there wasn't that many international opportunities in Belfast. And I just wasn't your typical bean counter, okay? I didn't have the long hair by this stage. But, you know, I just couldn't see myself sitting behind the desk, you know, totting up the books and adding up the numbers all day long. You know, I didn't go to the right golf club or the right rugby club. And don't get me wrong, the world needs a bean counter. Some of my best friends are the best finance gurus in Northern Ireland. But I just had these itchy feet. I just really, really had these itchy feet. So, you know, I managed to find a company. They're actually headquartered in Philadelphia in the U.S., but they hired me into their London office. In fact, I still remember going, flying over for the interview. I think it was a bank holiday Monday. And me and the boss, he was actually called Chris as well. We really hit it off at the time and offered me a job there and then. So I flew back to Belfast, said my goodbyes, and essentially went off to London to start work for, it was a company called Unisys. Now, I'm not sure whether any of you guys have heard of Unisys, but you should have, because they invented the computer. They invented, I think, the first sort of personal/business computer back in the 40s or 50s.
Wow.
I think if you go to the Washington Smithsonian Institute in D.C., I think they have, it's the Remington Rand and the Sperry Univac there in a big glass case, wow. Big shiny glass case. But they hired me in a position that was called internal audit. Now, I don't know how you describe internal audit without getting into
Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes, absolutely. The detective, the policeman, and we would sort of, essentially I rocked up for my first day in London. They handed me an American Express card. They handed me a laptop, and that was me. I spent the next 2.5 years on the road in Europe.
Crazy.
I think by lunchtime I was on the plane to Amsterdam, which is amazing. You know, that 22 years later, 23 years later, here I am and living here.
Absolutely.
But that was just amazing. You know, you'd spend a month in Amsterdam and then a month in Brussels and then a month in Paris and then a month in Germany and then a month in Prague and, you know, just pretty much traveling over Europe doing this detective work. So I was able to combine, you know, those finance skills. And I think accountancy is normally probably seen as, you know, not the sexiest or exciting profession in the world. But to me, I think it gives you a really good platform to launch any business career or any professional career. So I'd certainly say to any of your listeners out there, if you're at high school, if you're at university, if you're thinking of going into the world of accountancy, it will certainly open doors for you on a very much a global scale. I think that the accountancy qualification is very much recognized worldwide.
And like you said, it's needed everywhere. I think now we're moving into the real, the white hot center of this story that I'm like, this is where things just get crazy. Talk to me about your, and in as little or as much detail as you want, because I understand there's some sensitivities in here, about your South American, I don't know, action movie sequence.
We'll call it. South American action movies. Well, we certainly lived dangerously, you know, So this was after a couple of years of flying around Europe. For some reason, the guys think I could speak Spanish. You know, my Spanish, I had done Spanish to A level.
The guy couldn't understand your Northern Irish accent. They're like, ah, he speaks a few languages.
he's speaking like, I could probably order a few beers in Spanish. So they sent me off to Mexico, like, and it was actually the year of the World Cup. I do remember that. I think it was 1998, because I remember Mexico winning a game and like 200,000 people just descending upon the it was the Plaza Angle or the Independence Square in Mexico, and I still have photographs of me in a Mexico football pub just getting covered by beer and all sorts of these Mexican supporters. But essentially, you know, that was then my love affair with South America for the next two and a half years. So similarly with what we had done in Europe, we did the same in Mexico. There was the three amigos. There was myself, there was a Brazilian guy, and there was a French guy. And we pretty much for the next two and a half years did the same detective work for the Unisys operating companies that we had done in Europe. You know, it'd be a month in Mexico, then a month in Costa Rica, then a month in Argentina, then a month in Chile. You know, once in a while we would decamp to Miami just to get a bit of, North American culture, because we had an office there. Miami in the 90s was a fantastic place. Ocean Drive and just the strip there, and so many good clubs and bars and stuff. But, you know, the beauty of it was, you know, we would work hard during the week. You know, we'd work to 7 or 8 o'clock every night, and we'd go out for a nice meal, and we were lucky enough, we were put up in nice hotels. But at the weekend, we could essentially do what we want. You know, we could check out of the hotel and put the money towards, let's say, this weekend we're going to go snowboarding up in the Chilean Andes, or we're going to go trekking across this glacier in the south of Argentina, or we're going to, you know, go to the Atacama Desert in North Chile. I think I even spent my 30th birthday there. Brilliant. And the local villagers put on a show and a performance. And, this was a tiny, tiny desert village with no electricity after 6 o'clock at night. And it's just the most humbling experience and welcome. But, you know, it was also, you know, whilst it was a fun place, it was also a dangerous enough place. You know, if you remember South America in the 90s, a lot of these countries hadn't been long out of dictatorships. In fact, I think some of them, you know, were still very much, you know, Chavez was still ruling with an iron fist in Venezuela. A lot of these countries were still coming out of dictatorships. So we had run-ins with police. You know, we were, you know, people looking for maybe bribes. You know, we had stuff stolen on us that wasn't always. I remember getting our bags nicked in a posh hotel in Peru, in Lima. And we had all the footage. The hotel had it on video camera. We had the security cameras. We watched it 5, 6, 7 times. Of course, by the time the police arrived, the videotapes had been wiped somehow. Wow. So a bit dodgy, so we lost that. But I think that one of the scariest experiences, and I won't name the country, I think as we were doing our detective work, we found something a little bit sensitive, and maybe, you know, we stumbled upon something that we probably shouldn't have found. So under the cover of darkness, we were pretty much bundled out of the office, put in a car, raced high speed to the airport, and essentially under armed cover and put on an airplane. And sadly, I haven't been able to go back to that country to this day. Wow. But not that I would let anybody, you know, South America is the most beautiful country. I mean, the people are amazing. The continent is just fantastic. There's so much to see in terms of nature and adventure and the warmth of the people. So
I guess out of the fire and into the frying pan then, and I think if I'm right, there's a career change in here as well, but Pakistan?
Pakistan. So there was me, you know, I was a vice president of Unisys, you know, living the dream. And, you know, I built a big center in India and in Amsterdam. But after about 20 years of Unisys, I just went, like, maybe it's time for a change. You know, I'm in the world of transformation where it's all about change and journeys. Maybe it's a time for a change for myself. So I remember getting this phone call going, hey, Chris, you know, we like what you do. You know, you understand the world of offshoring and outsourcing and shared services. We're a telecommunications company. In fact, they were one of the 10 biggest telecommunication companies in the world. We're looking for somebody to build shared services, big delivery centers in Ukraine and Pakistan. And I was like, wow, you know, it's a little bit like us growing up in Belfast. You know, when you'd watch the TV in the 70s and 80s, you know, the troubles were always on the front of the BBC News. But, you know, we still got on with life. You know, right? Things happened, but, you know, they were, you know, people still lived a normal life. Yeah. And maybe the media always presented a different picture of it. I think that was the same with Pakistan. Now, it is, you know, when we were in Pakistan, I would pretty much have to have armed security with me everywhere we go. They would sleep outside the hotel room. The hotel, I think, that we had four rings of concrete around it. Unfortunately, the CEO of this telecoms company had lost his life in a bomb attack there at the Marriott Hotel a few years earlier. So it was, look, it was a dangerous place, but I think it's one of the most, beautiful places I've been to in terms of the warmth of the people. I'd spent a lot of time of my career in India, and if you think about it, up until 1947, India and Pakistan were the same country. So I think in terms of the personalities of the people and their schooling and their education system, which I guess it was always both in India and Pakistan based very much in the British education system, similar to what we've been used to in Northern Ireland. I just, we built the delivery center there. I would fly in every couple of months and meet the team and work with the team. And again, it was a humbling experience to be in a beautiful part of the world. In fact, I wish I'd spent more time to be able to travel around the country. We were pretty much based in Islamabad, which is actually quite a new city. I think it was actually only built in the 60s, so it had very big structured boulevards and roads and nicely divided into sectors and zones. But yeah, it's just a humbling experience to have sort of gone from working in Western Europe over to South America and then into Pakistan. So
Drinking sour milk in Kazakhstan.
it's not just sour milk, Matt, it's fermented sour milk. It gets you drunk.
It's horse milk, is it?
It's horse milk.
Oh,
Oh,
legendary.
wow. I don't think I knew this before we went. So we were doing a bit of work in Kazakhstan, and Kazakhstan is about as far east in Europe as you can get. I think it's like a 6-hour flight from Amsterdam. And I was actually working, and this was again part of the same telecommunications company. And there was actually a guy from a consulting firm. He's from Enniskillen, believe it or not, living in Switzerland. I won't embarrass and I won't name him.
Class.
And I remember we arrived in Astana, which I think is, I'm not sure it's the capital city of Kazakhstan, but maybe it's the second biggest city in Kazakhstan. And we get out of the airport and it's like minus 50 degrees.
Flip me.
Now this guy from Enniskillen whips on the balaclava, brought some interesting memories of Northern Ireland back. But it was certainly, you needed it. You really couldn't be in the cold for more than 10 or 15 seconds. So anyway, we get to the hotel, we freshen up, we wash up, and go, okay, let's find a local restaurant. So we find a local restaurant and ate the local food. But our host said, okay, now if anybody's really brave, you've got to try the local delicacy. And we're going, okay, what's the local delicacy? And it's called kurmis, and it's what it is. It's actually is fermented horse milk. So I guess the Kazakhs, when they were galloping across the plains, Kazakhstan's very flat country, you've got the steep and the plains. So I think to keep them warm in the winter, they used to take the old horse milk and ferment it in a leather sack. So, this horse milk would go sour, it would go stinky, it would become alcoholic. But weirdly, I loved it.
Wow.
Now I have to say, I think a few people at the table were looking for the airplane sick bag, but I love my sour beers as well, but it's a very, very unique and unusual taste. Now, I don't think you can probably find it in the convenience stores in Amsterdam, let alone Belfast. But if you ever see fermented horse milk, I would certainly recommend you have a wee tipple.
Yeah, give it a shot. Give it a shot. Yeah. This is I've said I wouldn't ask a question, but this is a wee random one popped into my head. What do you do on airplanes? Like, because you've spent a huge portion of your life on a plane. Like, I'm sure you get into like a little rhythm and a little groove, but how do you kind of put the time away?
Yeah, no, you're right. So I've spent hundreds, thousands and thousands of hours over my career on airplanes, and not always up the front. A lot of the time, in most of my career was actually in the back of the bus as well, when especially when we were building our center in India. I just love movies, and especially the last 10 years with we've got three young kids at home. All three of my kids are in primary school, certainly in their early years I had no chance to watch TV or movies. When I get on an airplane, I'm just happy to open the laptop or whatever. I guess the entertainment systems are a bit better these days on the airplanes, and I can watch three or four movies,
Awesome.
A few drinks, three or four movies, and listen to a lot of heavy metal. And it's just I sort of zone out. I mean, I love traveling, and I know a lot of people, probably nervous flyers or don't like flying. But yeah, I love getting, as you say, almost in the zone. You're in your little bubble for 8 to 12 hours. You don't have the social media or the email pinging off. And yeah, it's almost me time, you know, which sounds almost very selfish, but I think it's a great way to just enjoy yourself.
Yeah. Very great. A big question.
And I really miss airplanes. What I would give for an airplane,
really?
I haven't been on a plane since nine months. We were lucky enough to make one trip back to Belfast last summer, but you know, this is a guy who's normally in an airport every week or every second week, and you know, not to have been able to do that during the pandemic has been tough. But I think it's allowed me to reflect on other things in life, you know, and spend a lot of time with the kids, a lot of time here in beautiful Amsterdam as well. So,
yeah, that's great. Something that doesn't really make a lot of sense to me, so maybe you can unpack it for me. Why did you go and work for a tire company?
Apollo Tires. Look, so Apollo Tires, you probably actually, if there's any Man United fans out there, I think they're actually a sponsor of Man United, but you actually see their hoarding or their advertising around the football grounds in the Premiership. Look, Apollo attracted me because I had missed India a lot. You know, when I had been at Unisys, you know, I'd started visiting India from about 2004, 2005. You know, this was at the very start of, let's say, the outsourcing offshoring boom. And I'd grown and developed this real affiliation for India. You know, I loved the food. I loved the India's chaotic. I mean, and it's so sad to see what's happening there at the minute. I mean, my heart goes out at the minute with you know, the COVID situation in India and the struggles that everybody's having out there with the oxygen. It breaks my heart. But I just fell in love with the country, you know, the people, the sights, the sounds, the smells, the noise, the chaos. And I had done 50 or 60 or 70 trips to India way back in the day. And I grew a team out there to over 500 people. And I think, you know, both professionally and personally, I think some of my best moments have actually been working with Indian cultures and Indian organizations. But of course, I had missed that when I was doing the Pakistan gig. You know, obviously, never the twain shall meet. You know, obviously, you know, given the political history and tension there, you know, we couldn't use Indian talent in Pakistan or vice versa. And I just had this opportunity to join this amazing family-owned company. You know, they had a headquarters in Amsterdam and a headquarters in Delhi. And again, just to really, you know, build another transformation journey, another organization. And it got me back out to India. You know, I was able to get on the plane once a month, go and meet our team in Delhi. And, you know, I still keep in contact with them today. And it's just, again, it's so sad to have seen what's happened to India. But that's, you know, I remember getting the tour of the tire factory. You know, I think that's one of the beauties about finance and about shared services and what I do. You know, you can move between industries. You know, a lot of what I focus on is, you know, paying bills, collecting cash. And so it doesn't really matter the type of industry. And I've been lucky enough to work across tech and telco and manufacturing and obviously now green. But I remember being in the tire factory in Enschede and just watching the process of how the carbon is turned from you know, chemicals and raw materials into these amazing tires, the Fredestein brand or the Apollo Tire brand that goes in cars. Not that I know anything about cars, of course, Matt, because I'm not sure if I told you, I never got my driving license.
Yeah, it's actually in my notes. I was like figuring out a way to bring that in, but that's
mad. Oh, so here's Chris working for a tire company, not knowing how to drive a car. I had failed my test miserably. Oh my God, now, I think living in Belfast when I was 16, 18, I didn't need a car. I guess if you grew up in the sticks in the countryside of Northern Ireland, I guess a car was essential. But I could just hop in the old red bus and be in the city centre. So I never really needed a car when I was growing up. But somewhere, I think, in my last year of college, somebody says, okay, you better get a car, Chris, or you better learn to drive. So I remember, I think my first driving lesson, and my dad took me out. Now, thankfully, the roads were empty. It was up around the Giants Ring there, so up that back road. We're coming up to this red light, and I had no idea what was brake and what was accelerate. So he goes, Chris, and I hit the brake. And I had no idea. I hit the wrong one, and I go flying through this red light. I don't think my dad ever got into a car with me again. I think I terrified him. But yeah, no, I failed my test miserably. I think they had the Boucher Road Driving Centre. And I don't know, I must have hit a parked car or gone up in the curb. And I think it terrified me for life. It dented. I'd never failed an exam up until that day. I don't think I've failed an exam since. But, you know, never, still haven't got my driving license to this day. So again, for any of you guys out there who don't want to drive, you can survive life without a driving license.
I mean, especially in a city like Amsterdam, you're on your feet there, like.
You're on your feet. Well, you're on your bike.
That's true.
You're on your bike, mate. No, I mean, I think it's one of the joys about Amsterdam. It is such a different city. It's such a bike-friendly city. Mm. You know, one of the things I love about Amsterdam, it's a capital city, but size-wise, it's not that dissimilar to Belfast. I think like we've got about 700,000 people live here within the city. I think it goes up to about 1.1 million if you take in some of the suburbs. But it's not a huge city, but the beauty is, unlike London or Paris, when, you know, I've spent time in these cities, where to try and meet your mates for a beer, it can be a logistical planning exercise to get 2 hours across town on a metro or a tube or an underground. The beauty about Amsterdam is you can hop on your bike, and within 5 to 7 minutes, you can be anywhere in the city.
That's great.
You know, and it's just such a friendly city for bikes. You know, I mean, my kids were all cycling on the roads here when they were 4 or 5 years old, which is quite amazing. Now, we're very lucky. We've got bike lanes everywhere. And again, you know, we have one of those big cargo bikes, you know, not having had a car. So that's how I do the weekly shopping. You know, I can get three kids in the cargo bike, get all the shopping in there, throw in a Christmas tree if needs be. And it's just a great way to see the city. It's like...
Totally. So a wee bit closer to home then. Talk to me about watching your newborn being treated in intensive care.
Wow. No, that is a story. So we found out that we were having twins. This was our twins were born, our 2000, double trouble, little did we know. But quite early on in the pregnancy, around about 20 weeks, you know, and the babies were tiny, they actually discovered that one of the twins was going to be born with a heart problem. So, which is worrying enough to go through the last sort of 3-4 months of pregnancy, knowing this and all the potential complications. But anyway, like my amazing wife, Claire, absolutely amazing. Not wife, she's a partner. We skipped the marriage, but as people tend to do in Amsterdam.
Sure.
But it's... you know, we gave twins, and little Riley, we named him, I think Riley means warrior or braveheart, and he really was, you know, he was born with one of the most complex, complicated hearts that surgeons and the cardiologists had seen. He had holes in his heart, he had issues with valves, he had issues with his aorta. Immediately, I think his twin was born first and Riley popped out 20 minutes later. And I just remember following him as Claire stayed with the other twin. I was, you know, he was immediately whisked off to intensive care where he stayed for the next, it was like 130 days.
Crazy.
This tiny, tiny little creature and stuck in an incubator. And so he had his first operation at about 14 days old. They unfortunately had to break the ribs. I mean, it's pretty scary. To fix something in the heart, and then but they had to let him grow because he was only born at about 2 kilos. But before he had major open heart surgery, he had to get the kids up to 5 or 6 kilos. So essentially, he spent those next 2 to 3 months in intensive care, you know, getting ready for his big major open heart surgery, which he had at the age of 3 months. And it was, you know, I think it's hard enough going through that through with one child, but you know. You're trying to do it in a different country. You're trying to juggle a day job. You're trying to raise the other twin. You're trying to raise his big sister, who's 3 or 4 years older. Now, we were very lucky. Some of our family members came over from Northern Ireland and were able to help us, but they couldn't do that all the time. But just to see this little guy, and you know, he had 3 or 4 surgeries, open heart surgeries, you know, up until he was 1.5, and every time it is heartbreaking. You know, you go in, you see them have the anesthetic and go under the knife, and there was a few close calls, and there was a few times that we thought we lost them. So the good news is today that the surgeons have done an amazing job. I mean, we pretty much lived in the hospital for 4 months. I hadn't heard of this, but there's a thing called the Ronald McDonald Foundation, and they actually pretty much put flats or houses with this amazing old Georgian house in next to the hospital where we lived with other families who were going through similar things in a little town called Leiden. It was just outside of Amsterdam. And we pretty much lived there, and it was funded by this Ronald McDonald Corporation, and they paid our to live in the house next to the hospital. So there was never a day Riley didn't have either myself or Claire with him. But yeah, amazing surgeons, amazing cardiologists, amazing healthcare system here in the Netherlands. We're very lucky that he's a healthy boy today. And, you know, my heart goes out, and I'm sure there's other parents listening here on the podcast today who have probably had similar issues with heart patient children's or kids born with CHD. But my understanding is in Northern Ireland, I guess because of lack of funding, they had to shut down that care, the ability to do the surgery in Northern Ireland. Now, I understand they have an amazing cross-border All-Ireland facility now in Dublin. But, you know, just again, you know, parents go through enough struggle and stress. Yeah, to have to go to England or Dublin. If you're living in Northern Ireland, to have surgery for these little kids. But look, I mean, yeah, it's we're touch wood. We're very, very lucky how it panned out. But to going through that in a different country, it's pretty. It gives you a different view on life. I mean,
yeah, I bet. And so, you know, being in the Dam, then, you probably were very close, or you definitely would have seen the Heineken, you know, experience or the factories and stuff out and about.
I've lived in Amsterdam 20 years. I love Amsterdam. Amsterdam gets a bad rap. You know, everybody, those easy jet flights are full every weekend. Everybody wants to go to the red light. Everybody wants to smoke weed, which is brilliant. And I absolutely love that part of town as well. But there is another part of Amsterdam as well. There's beautiful canals, beautiful building, really good culture scene, really good music scene. So we live in this part of the pipe called part of Amsterdam called the Pipe. It's really multicultural. You know, I think we live beside the longest daily street market in Europe. It's about a kilometer long, and it's just full of, you know, Suriname food, Turkish food, Moroccan food, South American food, you name it, all sights and sounds from all over the world. But just two streets behind that is the Heineken Experience, which is actually the site of the original Heineken brewery. I think it was 1864. Mr. Heineken, or the son of Mr. Heineken, you know, made his first batch of beer there. They later moved the brewery out of the city, and actually it's now in a place called Zuiderwoude. But, you know, when I look from my apartment, I could see the Heineken Experience. I could see the Heineken and building. And like, I'm a complete craft beer geek, you know, ever since the days in Belfast when, you know, before we would go to the, you know, the student union, we would have a carry out of, you know, German beers or Singapore beers or back in the day. And I've really carried that through. I'm a complete craft beer geek. So I had this opportunity. They reached out to me about a year and a half ago to join their team as part of their finance transformation journey to help change. And it was hard to say no. You know, a global brand, some of the best marketing in the world, right on my doorstep within the brewing industry. And it was, you know, it's a legendary Dutch brand. I mean, what could be more Dutch than Heineken? it's been a great experience. Obviously I joined at an interesting time. You know, 4 weeks later, the pandemic hit, all the restaurants and the bars closed in Amsterdam. People stopped, you know, drinking beer in pubs. And you think a lot of the stuff that Heineken is famous for, the Champions League and the events and the James Bond, you know, a lot of that got put on hold, and quite rightly so, as people focused on health and the pandemic. But, you know, now with the bars, last Wednesday, the bars opened up again here in Amsterdam. Finally, and I think they opened up on Friday in Belfast today, finally we were able to get out and have a pint on the terrace in the beer gardens again. So hopefully, you know, there's light at the end of this road now, and hopefully we can come out at the end of the pandemic. But it's been great to be associated with a fantastic company like Heineken. And I think it shows, you know, through my journey, whether it's, you know, Unisys or Vion or Apollo Tires or Heineken, I think it shows that there are global opportunities out there for the youth of Northern Ireland today. Absolutely.
Brilliant, man. Well, look, just landing the plane then and wrapping up then, there's a series of kind of stock questions that we ask everyone that we've the chance of speaking to. I'm going to hit you with three today. The first one being maybe a strange one, but I think it's quite interesting. What's your most successful moment or your most proudest moment?
That's interesting. I'd probably say, you know, from a professional perspective, and I'll keep it professional, I think, you know, given that this is for Northern Ireland connections, let's look at I've got many, many happily personal moments, but from a professional moment, I'd probably say there's two. You know, I mentioned my affiliation with India. I think one of the proudest things that I've done is really building our team in India from zero to about 500 people. Now, I obviously didn't do it on my own. I had an amazing team around us as well. But, you know, just working and really building from scratch. I still remember being in the building when they were actually putting up the bricks. I was walking around in a hard hat as they were doing the construction. I think we even went live. We're trying to process accounting transactions, and there's little plaster coming down on top of us as they build the second floor and the third floor on top of our head. But that to me, because that blossomed and grew to something very, very successful. But I think it was about this time a year and a half ago, the industry I work in, shared services and outsourcing, actually presented me with a Lifetime Achievement Award. Now, I'm a little bit offended at the lifetime. You know, I've only just turned 50.
You've done well, mate. Hang up the boots.
But no, unfortunately, I reckon I've got another good 20 years in me. But you know, and that completely took me by surprise. And we were at a big industry event, and I was hauled up on stage and embarrassed. But very, very humbled and honored to be part of such a fantastic profession of you know, finance professionals and thought leaders across the world. So probably, and I'm sure there's other proud moments as well. An amazing family.
Unbelievable, man. Really cool. I'm going to sneak another one in then, because they usually ask it. And then I was like, well, he's already talked about his son. But if we stick to professional, then what about the most challenging moment in your professional career? And if you don't mind sharing, how were you able to overcome it?
Yeah, challenging moment. Now, that's a good question. I guess there's been many challenging moments, and I've talked about some of the interesting parts of the world that I work in. I think one of the things that we do is when we run transformation journeys, you know, it's about change. And unfortunately, sometimes the change can impact people. And I remember, you know, I was the leader of this amazing center here that we had in Amsterdam, and we had grown it, and it was amazing. But, you know, as the world changed, as Amsterdam got more expensive and people were looking to offshoring and outsourcing, we really had to start breaking the operation down. And this, you know, people that had been there for 10, 20, 30 years, you know, making those positions redundant. And I think that is truly heartbreaking. And, you know, essentially that's what we do. I mean, change is constant, I think, in the world of what outsourcing, offshoring, you know, we're always growing something, but if we grow something, it normally means shrinking somewhere else. So I think, unfortunately, now the good thing is to be able to overcome it, you know, I think we were lucky being in the Netherlands. I was able to strike good deals with the social partners, with trade unions, with works councils. And I think most people got looked after. We were able to find them another position, got them a good package. But look, I think, you'll probably ask anybody in the industry of what we do. That is probably the hardest. You know, we talk about the sexy stuff, about moving stuff to India or Manila or Costa Rica or wherever these countries in the world that have amazing offshore locations. But it normally means taking the work from somewhere else. And it's just, yeah, I think it's just part of life, and it's part of change. And that, you know, that if you treat people with honesty and respect and do the best for them, even if, you know, they may not have a job, but they may have to leave the company. I wouldn't say it gets easier. You know, I did that 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it's something you still got to do. It just never, never gets easier.
It's tough. Well, it's really tough. I hear you. One of the other questions then is, if you could take anyone from Northern Ireland, dead or alive, out for, in your case, we'll say a pint, who would you take?
Oh,
and why?
Can I take two people? That's a great question. You know what? I don't know if the guys are listening, but Andy Kearns and Michael McKeegan, the bass player and the guitar player and singer from a band called Therapy. So they're not from Belfast, but they are from Northern Ireland, Lorne and Ballyclare, and maybe their drummer Neil, but he's from Derby. Therapy are a band that I have grown up with. I still remember seeing Therapy's first ever gig in the Art College, probably 1990
Fair
or
play to
91.
you. Unreal.
Unbelievable. And I think they've just published a book, their 30-year plan. So I guess they've been around for 31, 32 years now. I just think the stories that Michael and Andy could tell, you know, they've gigged all over the world, played festivals with Ozzy Osbourne. Look, I'm a complete Therapy diehard. Even more so than Stiff Little Fingers, my favorite band from Northern Ireland ever. You know, I could talk to Andy all day about punk. I could talk to Michael all day about heavy metal and Saxon and Rainbow and Mama's Boys. And I would probably love to have a pint or a beer with those guys. And I still follow them all over the world. I mean, you know, I go to little towns. You'll have to get your Dutch Atlas out now. But places like Alkmaar or Apeldoorn or Leiden, or, you know, in the back end of nowhere in the Netherlands, I'm always hopping on a train on a Friday night or Saturday night when they're on tour to get to see them. So that's probably
great answer. Straight in as well. Like you were just like, a lot of people hesitate on that, and you were just pulled the trigger straight in. Like, great.
Yeah, I think we shared similar upbringings, you know, and I think, you know, I mean, we very much grew up with the same cultures and traditions, you know, seeing Metallica back in, or Ozzy Osbourne back, you know, in 86 in the Avenue Leisure Centre or the Ulster Hall, and or going to sort of punk concerts or hanging out at, you know, the Jarrow's Warzone Collective. Yeah, I think there could be so many stories, you know, swapping and sharing fanzines or record collections and just, yeah. Kudos to the guys from Therapy. Fantastic band. And if your listeners don't know them, you can go and Spotify them now.
Unreal. I think they're playing in Limelight soon. They're always playing.
Oh, you know, I had tickets for that. So I had, that was the week after my 50th birthday. So I had bought, that was at least the original date was, I think that was last September.
Yeah.
So my birthday was in September. So I'd bought tickets for me and all my mates from Belfast, all my old bean counter accountancy friends, you know. I was going to drag them down into the mosh pit, into the circle pit. And yeah, they'd probably, not sure I'll be able to get a metal t-shirt on them. But we all had tickets. And then the bloody pandemic, the gig was cancelled. I guess I couldn't have travelled anyway. But whenever that's rescheduled, my ticket will still be valid. So Matt, I'll see you there for a pint.
Well, mate, we're just opposite. So our studio is just opposite the Limelight in the Ormo Bass there. So you're more than welcome. We'll
set to many a fun night at the Limelight. Absolutely.
Very good. Well, mate, final question then. It's a question we always end with. And it's very simply this. If you could go back to an 18-year-old version of yourself and you had a few minutes of, you know, 18-year-old Chris's time, what would you say to him?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, yeah, if I can go on my time machine, I think just be yourself, believe in yourself, you know, everything is possible. You know, I didn't necessarily have a plan. I mean, when I was 18 years old, I was running around, going to concerts, drinking in the pub, going to the student union. I didn't think I would end up in Amsterdam. I didn't think I'd be vice president of a finance of a big American global corporation. Sort of 12, 13 years later. I mean, I didn't have a plan. So I think just believe in yourself. Do what makes you happy. You know, if you find something that you get energy from, just keep doing it. You know, be yourself. Don't be afraid of what other people think of you. You know, if you're into your counterculture, you want to have long hair, just do it. You know, I mean, I think the world has changed now. I think we're a lot more into inclusion and diversity than maybe, you know, the world was back in the 80s when I was a teenager. But just be yourself. You know, I'm a big believer in the growth mindset, you know, a concept of a growth mindset that, you know, if you keep believing in something, you keep practicing something, you know, just get out of your comfort zone and make that magic happen. So, look, I wouldn't change anything, I think, on the path that I've taken in terms of my career or by, you know, just taking it as it comes. But, you know, don't be afraid. If you want to go live in a different country, you know, do it before you regret it.
Absolutely. Well, look, thank you very much for listening. I really appreciate you hanging out with myself and Chris over the last hour or so. Like I said, this is made possible by NI Connections, this series, and you can head over to their website, niconnections.com, to sign up to their free monthly newsletter and check out other episodes in the series with members from the Northern Irish diaspora. You can also check out bestofbelfast.org or any podcast app to find over 200 conversations just like this one. Not quite like this one, but featuring interesting people like Chris and other people from this part of the world. And Chris, mate, other than that, I just want to say thank you so much for taking your time to do this today.
Well, Matt, thank you for having me. And thank you to Northern Ireland Connections and Invest Northern Ireland for putting us in touch as well. You know, I love to spread the brand of Northern Ireland anywhere I go in the world. I mean, I think it's a great country, great people. And hopefully I'll get back to see my family and my friends soon.
Totally, mate. And like, you know, like I said, I've done over 200 of these, and the guys from NI Connections are constantly sending me emails. Do you know this person? Do you know this person? I'm like, no, I've never heard of them. And I'm just like, I'm so grateful that that this connection was made, and I look forward to seeing where it goes. So yeah, thank you.
It's a small world. Well, thank you for your time today, Matt, and absolute pleasure talking to you.